Hey friends, it's been a while since my last podcast. I've recorded one with John Anthony, Kindred Spirits. By the way, you can find Kindred Spirits at kindredspiritspod.substack.com. We've decided to place them there. So season two has been humming along wondrously. I think we've got two or three episodes out so far. So if you've been missing Kindred Spirits, they're there. They'll be happening. The Fox Wizard podcast, originally Questing Betwixt, although I don't know what it's going to quite turn into just yet. I had hoped, as I finished my last episode in the last season with Knowledge of Curses, I had hoped to have something all prepared for you by now. It just hasn't happened that way. So this is what I'm calling a little poetic interlude, because the opportunity to have a conversation with a dear, dear, dear friend of mine, Matthew Stillman, emerged. And I thought this would be such a lovely thing to share with you. As some of you may know, if you've been listening deeper into the Fox Wizard lore, you will understand that there was a time that I was in the dark forest. So I was a bit of a cocoon chapter, dissolution, a bit of a funk, a bit of a window of disenchantment that was stepped through. And thankfully, I found myself on the other side. But one of the key components of that was an awakening of the heart to, amongst other things, nature, time with friends, the body, poetry. And I have many friends that don't quite get the poetry thing. I was in this situation myself. For many times, I'd appreciate the cleverness of how a poet would aptly describe or, you know, distill, you know, nebulous phenomena into an expression that evoked a felt sense. I would love David White's articulation that poetry is language to which we have no defenses. And yet in the 5 years in the, you know, awakened from bushfires and then deepened via a pandemic, in that time that I was questing in the dark forest, my gosh, the poetry worked wonders on me. One of the things I did recently was actually attend Matthew Stillman's Committed to Heart, Committed to Memory, which is a course that he teaches, in which I found myself gifted through the wisdom of this course and the wonderful people who attend the ability to recite from the heart poems that were shared. And I don't know, I find this so important, particularly in these times of flux. Poetry, for me at least, is a gateway into a deeper kind of wisdom, a deeper conversation with life, with a capital L. And Matthew Stillman is one of the most well-versed and kind, warm-hearted, curious, funny folks that I have the delight of knowing. Now, you'll hear in this episode, Matthew and I, we talk a little bit about Finite and Infinite Games, A Vision of Life as Play and Possibility by James P. Carse. This was the original connecting thread. Matthew was subscribed to my newsletter and reached out many, many years ago based upon my continued referencing of this book. He is more of a Carsean than I am. I mean, I love James Carse so much, but Matthew actually has spent time with him. And I think it was about 20 years ago that he first encountered Finite and Infinite Games. So you're going to hear in this episode two friends converse. I mean, I couldn't help myself. I became meta-conscious of the fact that this is a podcast recording and you're going to be listening. And so there was a bit of an egregore-like element in that. But you're going to hear two friends have a conversation that wends its way through Finite and Infinite Games, through to poetry and all sorts of things. So I hope you enjoy this. I should have actually prepared this beforehand. If you want to find and follow Matthew, you can do so. You can find him on Substack, Stillman Says. And I think if you look up Stillman Says, S-T-I-L-L-M-A-N-S-A-Y-S, you'll find him there. And he also has a website, which I'm just going to load up now. Yeah, just hang with me. This is a kind of professional, the professional podcasting. This is what you're here for, right? Oh, it's bloody StillmanSays.com. Well, there you go. Oh, gosh. But yeah, and Matthew is a beautiful person, and I think you're going to enjoy this episode. Now, he's next committed to heart, committed to memory. If you're listening to this relatively soon after this episode comes out, some opportunities are still available to partake in that. But otherwise, I'd still suggest that you get in touch with Matthew, get onto his list. He does it in a charming, how do we say that? There's a handedness. I think he used that expression. This is not sign up to some automated list and be subject to AI-generated missives sent as part of a pipeline. This is a very human thing. So you can find out the details of that in the post accompanying this or connect via Substack or so forth. Anyway, without further ado, I really should have actually prepared the notes for this before ensuring it. Without further ado, actually, you know what? Oh no, I won't say it. I was just gonna share his email straight up. You'll hear it in the unfurling of the podcast. And if it warms and if this feels like a resonant connection, it'd be something I heartily encourage. Enjoy the episode. It was recorded very early in the morning for me. Well, not very early, but early enough that took a little bit for the coffee to kick in. And then wondrous conversations emerged. So enjoy that. Foxwizard.com for my stuff. I've got some exciting things emerging. School of Fox Wizardry is still... I'm still working with the Dark Forest operating system behind the scenes to kind of get that into a state of readiness for you. And there's other updates too, but foxwizard.com for me. Enjoy Matthew Stillman and the conversation that I have with him. And I'll see you again soon. Yes. Yeah. It's probably too early to mention your sex tapes. So let's
never do it. No, the Pink Panther Pedant is the name of my next sex tape, obviously.
That's right. Oh dear.
Well, doesn't everybody call their genitals their Pink Panthers?
We can bring it back. Okay, great. So I feel like the coffee is kicking in. So there is this. Okay, so for folks listening, this is where I'm going to directly address the listeners. It's been a while since I've done a podcast, and this has been one that I've been wanting to do for a very long time. For I don't know how long now. It's been. It feels like it's definitely been more than a year. Matthew Stillman, my guest today, my friend. We've been in conversation almost pretty much weekly for with the occasional skipped week for so long. And I had the absolute joy of attending one of Matthew's poetry courses, Committed to Heart, Committed to Memory, Committed to Heart. And it was one of the most subtly profound experiences I've ever done. And it stays with me and lingers today. And there are going to be themes in our conversation today around poetry. And I want to clumsily adopt the perspectives that perhaps I once held and just give voice to them because they may be present for some folks listening, where once upon a time I'd appreciate poetry kind of from a distance. So I'd admire the cleverness of the words and so on. But the catalyzing effect of when it really infuses into the heart and works its magic in that way is something I'm only relatively recently acquainted with, and I'm excited to explore some of these themes with Matthew. Matthew has a very rich life and way of seeing things I find quite resonant, hence why we've spent so many sessions and conversation together. So I always, Matthew, I try to kind of do this warm and personal intro. There are many things that I've missed that may surface during our conversation, including, you know, here, Matthew, there's a particular domain that I don't know if it's my place quite to say, but there's a particular element that binds our, well, not binds, but that is a shared element of our friendship, which is a respect for James Cass and the work mm-hmm. of the philosopher James Cass, who some folks may know of Finite and Infinite Games, but is also the author of many other books, including The Religious Case Against Belief, The Silence of God, Breakfast at the Victory, and more. Matthew, wonderful to have you here. I'm so excited that the listeners may get to experience what eventually, as the self-consciousness of introducing a podcast disappears and we just sink into the flow of a natural conversation together, I'm delighted that they're going to experience some of your wit, wisdom, and warmth and wiles as we navigate this space. But I wonder if we might start with, if it's okay, we might start with James Cass and all of that stuff, and then wend our way through to poetry and possibly even theology.
But the girls. So James Cass. So James Cass, was a professor at New York University and other places, but that's where he sort of spent a lot of his professional career. He lived in New York City when he was alive as most of his teaching career, professor of comparative religion and literature as well. And I never had him as a professor. I came to know him later in his life, though he still had professorial aim and air, and still was working as an emeritus professor, sort of like showing up when he wanted to when I came to know him. If he's famous at all, which I don't know that he is, but if he's famous at all, he's famous for his book, Finite and Infinite Games, which there's lots to say about the book, but just to say that's the book, and maybe we could draw that out. But the book, I'll just say a touch about it, posits that there are at least two different types of games that one could play, finite and infinite games. Neither one is superior to the other. They just are particular types of games with particular types of players who engage with them. Finite games are played to be won, or played for status within those games. So you could think about any sort of court game, basketball, baseball, football, rugby, whatever. And there's sort of rules that
Court. Yeah.
Going to court. Court itself would be a game. Or becoming a regional manager. Not everyone can become the CEO of, Company X, but some people can compete to get status. So that is a finite game. And there's nothing wrong with a finite game. And then there's infinite games, which are not better versions. There's different ways of playing different games. But those are games where the boundaries and the rules change in the state of play for the sake of keeping the play in motion. And he sort of takes that basic idea and then unpacks it as some of the implications of that into other fields like history, relationships, science, our understanding of our connection to and with nature, what machines are, technology, and culture and civilization making.
So all right, we're gonna dive a little deep and explore some tangents because the whim decreased. You were so significant in my own appreciation for Finite and Infinite Games. This is a book that I would reread and reread each year just because I love it. I delight in it. I don't need to be reminded of it necessarily, but I delight in the recounting. But for many years, perhaps this is in my adolescence, I would carry the whole thing of like, oh, mere finite games. I am an infinite player, And I think that still kind of exists as in...
And that
there is this interesting framing you point out. There are at least two kinds of games. He has this beautiful way of opening the book with that expression. But at the end, he kind of makes a point that there is only one infinite game, which is... exquisite because it says that there are at least two, and then it leaves this open mystery. Hang on, well, what's this? What's this other thing?
Yeah.
Which opens the horizons once more. But there is, I would say, for folks that have done a cursory read on this and even just kind of grasped the basics of this, there is something much more poetic and sublime once we sink into this perhaps a generative paradox or a way of relating that's horizontal in nature where, you don't do as I do as for many years, or maybe you do, but then you get to transcend that, where it's not about, you know, oh, you know, infinite game. You start to just recognize the many finite games that exist within the infinite game. And through that perspective, you can then start to engage with the boundaries with, and you know, another term that you reminded me of earlier in our conversations is sometimes we need to bring a provisional seriousness to the games that we play. But it's still provisional. But then people forget their infinite nature. They, as James Cass would say, they self-veil. And they, what was the line he uses? They forget to remember to forget, or something like that. But they forget the voluntary nature of the play, and then enact a kind of terminal seriousness. And I guess there's partly, I didn't want to go this direction too early, but there has, you know, as part of when good ideas, when good ideas tend to kind of, in my world, at least my understanding, come from the penumbra or the kind of the edges. In the instance of finite and infinite games, it's become briefly popularized by Simon Sinek with his book, The Infinite Game. But I also feel like there are some many subtler qualities that are profound and vital that the book itself missed, that that James Cass was able to posit, which segues on to maybe the more subtle, sublime things of the poetry. But let's... I'd be curious if you want to jump on any of those things that I just kind of...
Yeah, well, I would say this, is that, you know, our delight in suddenly talking about this possibly obscure author to most, and some of the ideas, and maybe the ideas of people who are listening who haven't heard of it are like, maybe this sounds interesting, that idea sounds broad, infinite sounds good, finite sounds bad, but here's someone or two people who have read this book a lot and again. So this book came to me, you know, as sometimes books do, like someone's like, oh, I think you probably would like this book. And it came to me, and if I had to look back, I think it was 1992, possibly 93. And I am a very bookish person. I'm not only a bookish person, but I'm certainly a bookish person. And I read the book by myself, and I loved it.
Can I just insert a little bit of lore
here? How dare you?
Yeah. You grew up in like close proximity or amidst a heap of books, right? As part of like a...
Yeah, well, this is part of the story. So, I mean, I was a person who was already inclined towards philosophical thought, spiritual practice of different kinds. I was interested in Eastern philosophy, Eastern mysticism. My father, when I was a kid... managed the world's largest and probably most important spiritual occult bookstore in the world called Weiser's. So I was raised in the stacks. We also, our family was involved in a school of Advaita Vedanta, along with being New York City Jews. So like...
Did you say raised in the stacks?
As raised in like the stacks of books? Absolutely raised in the stacks.
That's a cool expression. I love that. Is that as opposed to raising the sticks?
Yeah.
So like... Oh, that's great.
There are pictures of, I mean, I quite literally, as a little kid, climbed bookshelves in Weiser's bookstore to read books, like sitting on the shelves.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. You know, and I had, I mean, just, this was, you know, I was born in 73. You know, I had, you know, tarot card coloring books. I had, you know, Shakyamuni Buddhist, you know, Tanka paintings as coloring books. I had Bhagavad Gita comic books, but I also had like, you know, like the regular old Egyptian Book of the Dead, which, you know, like there are pictures of me like holding it, but you know, at six, like, are you reading the Egyptian Book of the Dead? No.
This is new images for me. I haven't had this yet. So just like imagining there's probably like silver chalk for like magical circles and stuff like that. You're just casually playing with and summoning demons and
no, it wasn't like that. But you know, those things were, you know, talk of them was around, but my father was a kind of serious practitioner, and he was like, that kind of stuff's nonsense. I mean, one of my father's, sort of cute little stories about this time is that, that sometimes people would come in and say like, I want a book on witchcraft. And my father would sort of size them up, like, I can't give you any books about witchcrafts. You can't be a witch. You're too short. And the person would be like, what? I'm too short? Ah, that's... And so not to say that my father was some sort of, you know, master of the craft. He wasn't. He was a wanderer and was attempting to be a practitioner and was bookish in his own way.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
Which is all to say that this book, this type of practice more broadly, fit on me. And when this book came into my life, I read it with zeal and gusto. It was at a time where I definitely was a reading reader, like really like, oh yeah, I always have pocket stuff full of books and books are cross-fertilizing. And I read the book and it really struck me. It's like, oh, this is good. But it provoked in me not a finishing of like, I finished it and now I've sort of extracted what I needed from it. It provoked in me conversation within myself, but it also made me want to read the book with other people. And that didn't happen right away, but I was like, and I sort of would read little sections to other people, like, what do you think of this? If I tell you this beginning, here's the premise, what do you think of this part? And so it really was a relational tool in the sense of like, I would love to hear what you think about this idea about, you know, X within the finite and infinite games construct. And I must have, I mean, it is without exception the book that I've bought most, given away most, and book clubbed most. And in those early years from, let's just say, 95 to the early 2000s, had dozens of book clubs with people where we'd sit around in a room once a week, twice a week, whatever, and read the book out loud to each other and talk about the ideas. And to me, that was thrilling. And, you know, people who, like, my wife at the time had never read the book. I was like, let's do a book club, the two of us. But also, like, someone had newly moved into the house that we lived in. Like, okay, I'll join you. And so, you know, Corinne Osborne was like, oh, yeah, and this is great. And, of course, some people were like, I don't get this book. This book's weird. And some people were like, wow, this is informative and thoughtful and cool.
This is so you would have read the book about 20 years before I first encountered it. And when I encountered it, James Cass was, you know, this obscure, but, you know, I was in academia at the time, and this almost mythical entity of like, oh, wow, this is like, they have this, you know, he was still alive at the time and so on. But you actually had the chance to hang with him.
This is the next part of the story. So before I take one step further into the story, I'll take two steps back. So, you know, the parents of mine who were interested in all these types of things sent me to a summer camp in Rowe, Massachusetts, the town of Rowe, R-O-W-E, which was a very seminal place for me, very groovy. It wasn't aligned with, you know, occultism or spiritual working per se, but it was really an important place in my life that and which I could say a lot about. But every night we would tromp as a camp down to this little chapel. We'd sit quietly by some steps as we decided to sort of reverentially enter into this very old church from the 1700s and do sort of varying different types of group theater, ritual acts, different kinds of things. It wasn't religious. It was really just like a group event. And depending on how many people decided to show up, nothing was mandatory at this camp. We would have a few stopping points as we walked down from the main camp down into the town proper. One of them was the library, but other places along the way were like, okay, we've got to stop here before we keep on going. And then in the winter of 2002 into 2003, Rowe Camp and Conference Center, which is a camp in the summers for kids. During the rest of the year, it's a conference center for adults, broadly in the sort of personal development, spiritual development, sort of a space. Mm-hmm. And it said, a weekend with James Karras, author of Finite and Infinite Games. And I was like, James Karras is, like, my James Karras is going to be at Rowe, where I spent all this time as a kid? And, you know, if you sort of have your ear to the weirdo wire, you sort of see names who are in particular circuits of going to, Yoga Retreat X or a Conference Center Y doing spiritual, and you sort of see like, okay, I'm never going to go see, I mean, certainly not now, but not even then, like Deepak Chopra or whoever else, or Healer X or Spiritual Teacher Y or Adyashanti. Like, you sort of get to know these names somehow because they're on the circuit. But James Carson was someone who I really loved. I was like, I've never seen his name anywhere. He's doing this? So I was like, well, I'm going. And so I went with my wife at the time, and I went with my housemate, Corinne Osborne, who lived in our house at the time and who loved the book. And we did that. We read the book together, Corinne's, Susan and I, many times. And again, I read it with other people too. We went up to Roe, had the, you know, the standard weekend away at these types of retreats, you know, a Friday afternoon gathering, a dinner, then sort of like the first, you know, lecture into the weekend. And we sort of know how like the rhythm of those things go. But on that Friday night, you know, I got to meet, you know, James Carson. Like, Professor Carson, it's nice to meet you. Please call me Jim. Okay, Jim. It's so great to meet you. I love your book so much. I'm really excited all for all this. I'm just wondering, why Roe? Out of all the places. And he says, oh, well, my wife and I, we split time between New York City and Roe. We live in the town of Roe. And I'm like, wait, what? And I said, he said, yeah. And he said, oh, we live at, you know, address X. And I was like, I sat on your stoop innumerable times on my way to chapel. It's like, oh God, kids used to sit out there all the time, you know, on some summer nights. Oh yeah. I was slack-jawed. I couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe it either.
That's right.
And so that weekend, he talked about what he talked about. We all asked the questions we asked. We made our observations, whatever we did. You know, people have talk during coffee breaks and lunches and things like that. And I'll just say after the breakfast on the final day on the Sunday, you know, I'm just like, I'm trying to be cool. Let's just say that I was being cool, but I definitely was like, Gibbon, this is awesome. I mean, this is, you know, half a life away for me. I mean, this is, you know, definitely more than 20 years ago for sure. I mean, it was 2000, it was the winter of, it was January for sure, of 2002 or 2003, I think. And I sort of had a few minutes alone with him at a breakfast table and said, like, this has meant so much to me. This is so great. I was wondering, like, I just had a question that sort of doesn't have a place in the main thing. I kind of had an idea and a wondering, could I ask you? I was like, oh, sure, sure. And I said, well, this book is so great for all the reasons that it's great. And I opened up these possibilities and here's the way I've been reading it. You know, all that. I was kind of thought that like there should probably be some kind of sequels to it that uses this as a frame to look at these traditions that have gotten so locked down. Like, what if there was like, is there, would it be, does it make sense to have a version of this book that would be called Finite and Infinite Judaism, about the different ways that Judaism itself looks at itself, or ways, and that you could do the same thing for Christianity, the same thing for Islam or Buddhism? It's like, I completely can imagine it now that you say it. I hadn't really thought of that specifically, but it's like, I give you full permission to write those. Please do. I would be so glad if you joined the conversation of where this could go. Of course. Oh, well, I mean, it seems like you obviously care about the book and the ideas. You certainly know it very well. If you ever want to get together in New York, you know, please, you know, here's how to get me. And I was like, I die. And, you know, the person who sort of started the Roe Conference Center was sort of friendly, but not friends with James. So I sort of had a bit of like respectability. I wasn't some, you know, super Finite Infinite Games maniac. It just was like a real circumstance. And Jim and I got to talk and hang out and be with each other. It's not like, you know, he suddenly became like my best friend or a daddy I never had or mentor and that we've, like, spent every weekend together. We just, like, sometimes spent time together and talked about books and talked about ideas, and other things too. And just, but I never was, like, invited into his house, like, never once. I mean, I knew where he lived, like, I walked him to it a few times. and walked by a cheese shop that we both knew, like, oh yeah, yeah. And we just, you know, stayed in touch for a couple of years, and then, as all things do, like, but, you know, we had an affection for each other, and so that's where that part of the story ends. But there's continue to read the book, continue to keep on finding new ways about it might be applied and wondered about, and new people to wonder with. And that's how you and I became in connection.
Yeah, yeah. You reached out, and there was a point in my life where, you know, I was very, very, I was brimming with hubris. I was flying about the place. I had, like, and I didn't pick up on the opportunity for us to catch up. Not intentionally. It just didn't quite happen. But I'm so glad that you.
The right time happened, though.
Yeah. You reached out again, and I can't remember when it was, but, you know, we've spent so many hours together since then. It's been just such a beautiful friendship that I would say that Finite and Infinite Games was the connective thread, because in my newsletters you'd kind of wonderfully pick up on some of the, you know, my enthusiasm for the book. But before we get to the present day, I think there's a parallel thing here that I'm sorry this is autobiographical. I hope it's not too squirmish for you, but I find it fascinating as we eventually get towards poetry. There's a time in which you were, I don't know how to phrase this, but effectively in the square, offering would you say, is it like...
I could tell you for a number starting in the spring of 2009, I set up, and there's a story of how I got to here. I thought this was a good idea. I set up a chair, two chairs and a table in Union Square in New York City, with a big sign that says "Creative Approaches to What You've Been Thinking About," a smaller sign that was on the table that says "Pay what you like, or take what you need," with a little jar of money that was there. But the jar of money also had marbles and chopsticks and lighters and little pieces of paper. And people would come and talk to me about something that they needed a creative approach to. It could be big or small, personal or professional, weird, or totally mundane. And I would try not to ever give advice. I tried to offer a creative approach to help them look at it differently, whatever it was. And people could pay in whatever they wanted to pay. That could mean money, that could mean hugs, that could mean art, that could mean TikTok, that could mean their last cigarette, that could mean anything. And it also means they could take whatever they wanted, which means take what I said or take money from the jar, but what they need, not what they want. But only after they had done the thing. So it wasn't just like an open piggy bank.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, so I sat out there for many, many years like it was my job, and ended up sitting and with thousands of people being out there.
The exquisite cross-section and the diversity of stories and the brief little insight or glimmer into what folks are wrestling with, and the conversations folks are having in their own heart, and what a beacon that would have been, or some sort of solace, or like a little oasis. And yet I also really appreciate, there's a bit of like how Lewis Hyde writes about the gift, like the framing being appropriate enough of a container in which there is some sort of exchange, but that wasn't not kind of corrupted by a heavy transactional overlay or some sort of like expectations. I can imagine being quite freeing to do or to speak to whatever needs to be spoken to without the, you know, corrupting influence of more overt finances. This I find particularly admirable because in this current phase of life where I've had quite a successful career in the past, you know, fleecing corporates whilst giving them some good value. In a phase right now where, you know, I'm drawn to, you know, I deeply see the genuine value of that. But then sometimes in this current world, value isn't necessarily recognized by the market. And what is true value often, and perhaps also maybe we don't want it to be, because sure, to put it in that light does some funny things. So I love that, you know, you had the sensibilities around how you frame that. And then I can imagine all the conversations, you know, each, we're touched by each of them. So there would have been had a shaping effect for you. I wonder for folks listening, because I've had a few examples, but would it be helpful to perhaps share an example of the kind of query or something that someone came to you at the time?
Sure. I mean, there were some broad categories, but all kinds of things could show up. And I would just add, before I tell you, you know, one particular story, which I don't know which one that'll be yet, was, it was a response to when the economy had just collapsed, you know, with the...
Right.
So I got laid off from the gig that I had, which was, you know, no one liked to be laid off. And so that was in March of 2009. And I knew that, I mean, I think anyone could have sort of read the room, as it were, in that time, like, oh yeah, you're not getting a short-term gig. Unless somehow you think that like restaurants are your thing. But I had a film that was coming out in theaters in the fall, that was a documentary film that I conceived of and wrote the treatment of and then wrote the and produced. It was a film called The End of Poverty with a question mark at the end, about the origins of poverty and why it persists in a world where there's so much wealth or riches. And so I knew that I was going to be working on the film, promoting it, like actually getting a meager but a paycheck starting in the fall. So I knew that, like, based on what's going on in the world, I'm not going to sort of get like a spring and summer gig that's going to sort of, I was like, I kind of got to kill time until, you know, September or October when my film comes out. So my response was, well, I don't have any status or stature. I'm just a guy. And people have told me enough that I'm good at helping them look at things in different ways. Not that they should look at it that way, but just like, oh, right, I'll try that on for a second. And that could be generative. But I thought, I don't know. But so I can't in good conscience sit out in the literal square, Union Square, and charge anyone for something, because I don't know what they're going to ask me. I might be no good at it in terms of like, oh, that's a thing that you want help looking at. I'm not the guy to talk to about that. I couldn't.
That's a quaint disposition in this current day and age. Everyone's just.
Well, that's my sensibility. I sort of have some notions on like, well, don't overpromise and don't think that you're going to actually overdeliver. Like, let's actually see. Anyway, so did people come with, you know, with career issues and questions, romance questions, conflicts with, you know, friends and neighbors? Sure. Did, you know, people come with sort of, you know, high-minded philosophical wonderings or actual scary things that are going on? Like, all those things happened. Mm-hmm. You know, so... And then sometimes people ask for one thing, but actually realize that it was something else that they were looking for that I didn't know what that was till we sort of talked for a while. And it wasn't therapy. It wasn't, but we came across things. So I don't know. I mean, there are so many stories.
Well, I'm just, you're speaking to the Gemeinschaft kind of quality of community, neighborly, kind of the interactions, the things that can only form or surface with dialogue. And I'm just contrasting this beautiful gift and offering, or just this proposition from around, I guess, 2008, 2009 time to where we had now, where you know, there's part of me right now is just feeling a bit sad that everyone's carrying this large language model in their pocket, and a lot of these questions that may be on their mind, it's just with the friction and ease, many will be just outsourcing this to the homogenized intelligence repackaged back to them via potentially dubious surveillance. And this with like the rise of streaming services, delivered to your door, all of these things that the wholesome friction of society seems to be smoothed away. And as a result, we're not having these encounters with other folks as often. And so thus we're not encountering.
Yeah. Wholesome friction is a great title too.
Mm. Okay. Oh dear. So for folks listening, the types, if they're listening this deep, why not? it's not even a joke. Wholesome freedom. Let's just say Matthew has many sex tapes that he's put out there, and Wholesome Friction is probably a good title. I'm sure there'll be more that emerge. I don't know. I'm just the thing that's alive for me right now is this realization of how enriching such a disposition towards the fabric of community and all the relationality, the willingness to entertain or dance with mystery because you don't know what the thing is, you're not charging it, you're not proclaiming that you have answers, you're simply exposing yourself to the encounter and then through dialogue seeing what surfaces and if you have something to offer, offering that, and if it resonates or who knows what, there is, you know, however it all unfurls, there's an incredible naturalness to it. It feels very organic. Nothing feels forced. And I don't know. It just surfaces for me because, again, this is another glimmer to what I'm kind of triangulating here on this sense of poetic sensibilities that is one thing to intellectually recognize and see, but to actually know it and embody it and have it infuse into the practice of how you live and show up in the world and how you see and perceive and relate to the gamut of experience and emotions and the textures of life. I mean, that's another step Would you be okay if I segue clumsily into the poetry conversation?
Clumbs away. They're not unrelated. I can see a few steps, so you can get there.
Okay. All right. Great. I can do it.
Here we are. Let me help you. So in talking about what I was doing at that table and chairs, it was a creative approach to my own moment at the time. It was my attempt to play like an infinite player, to change the rules for a little while until I was going to fall back into the parameters of more traditional work for a little while. And so it was an experiment to sort of see what would happen as opposed to, and so I'd say that was a poetic response without giving it any quality or saying that it was a really good job. And look, I made a little bit of money, but not loads, and but I was out there like it was my job, but I was enjoying it, and it certainly turned into some cool, you know, side consulting gigs, which were completely not reliable, but they were alive. But the whole experiment as a whole, which lasted for as long as it lasted, was a joyful thing, but it was a poetic response to a particular type of constraint that had happened, and that it ended up being a relational thing that has informed me, and I also got formed by. As well as I formed it with the idea. And so that poetic response didn't specifically have to do with poetry in the sense of, you know, my love is like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June. But it's not unrelated either. So.
Exactly. This is the thing. I have friends who are wonderfully, wonderfully smart, astute. They have their own kind of wisdom. And I can just tell that when it comes to poetry, for some, this is going to sound really crude, but it hasn't quite landed yet. Speaking for myself, I went through many years of appreciating poetry, like nodding along, or, you know, if I went to a poetry reading night or recital, you know, I'd be like, yeah, that's good. But I feel like it was still largely through the head. Like I wasn't, I was perhaps very head driven, and I feel like our society is still largely that way. And I know that, you know, sometimes people hear of poetry and so on, and I think, oh, feels like I'm missing something. I should go about this. And then the avenues for folks, you know, they might go to the poetry section of the bookstore, and then, you know, here we'd have like the top 50 Australian bush poets or whatnot, and you'd open it up and you'd flick through it and you're like, huh, okay, yeah, Spinifex and Horizon, and yeah. But there's a kind of a murky, not barrier, but there is some sort of gap that, I don't know. For me, it was like, you know, the passing away of my father figure, and the grief and ecological grief, and just all this suppressed sorrow, and the protracted chapter in a dark forest dissolution that finally opened me to just the utter solace and warmth and transformative affect that poetry can bring. And it was such a profound, not so much remedy or antidote or anything like that, but it was such a, there's such a kind of, even medicine doesn't seem quite weird, but a kind of nourishment that was needed, at the time. My partner Kim is much more, you know, I guess everyone has their own relationship to this, but she's been, you know, across it a lot longer than me. Mm-hmm. And so you offer this course, and you've been doing this for many years, and you've been helping folks
about 3.5 years. Yeah.
All right. Okay. That's almost many in my book.
No, it is. I'm just to be clear, it's not like I've been cooking this and doing this, you know, in the internet hinterlands for 20 or something.
Okay, well, yeah, it certainly feels to me that, you know, well, I guess it's your life experiences infused through this, because sure, there's such a natural grace that you bring to this. I wonder if it's okay if I read a couple of paragraphs from a recent email that you sent.
Yeah, of course.
I just love the way you describe this. Listeners, forgive me, I'm slightly dyslexic when reading, but we'll get this. Friends, if the word poetry said with a slightly pretentious English accent makes you roll your eyes, then I can only imagine that the word theology, barked seriously through tweed and pipe smoke, might cause a double take with a depleted chin put to chest in response. I love that. My beard covers that, but that expression. If that is true for you, then I understand, I think, because poetry and theology have each had manacles clamped on them for a long time. And poetry and theology have been leg ironed and cuffed to two of the most compromised institutions we have, school and houses of worship, pick your favorite flavor, and been forced to serve very particular ends of superiority and silencing, while also mostly diverted from a riverun of joy and relational possibilities. Who could love a mostly disconsolate and cheerless pair like that? And I love your writing and your way. And I think there is this thing you aptly point. I mean, I was taught poetry in school, and I've seen academics talk of poetry where they put it up and they're analyzing, they're dissecting the things and so on. And the experience I've had, and it might be the same for many, is either it's been something you were kind of forced to learn at some point that you didn't necessarily connect to, or the experience of it was quite clinical or analytical, or and
bloodless. Yeah.
And bloodless. Yeah, yeah. And so I would – here's the question I have for you. Because you do have another one of your courses coming up starting in early May, Committed to Heart, Committed to Memory. I did this a few months ago. And as I said before, it was profound. Yeah. I found myself just unbidden reciting from the heart the poem by Yeats that I learned, that experience. It's been moving. The question I have for you is, what are the kind of, how might you describe what might be going on for some folks that might feel called or moved to undertake such a course?
Well, blessings on the head of anyone who still wants to engage with poetry at all. If you were subjected to being told in school, you have to memorize this poem, which we know is important because of X, Y, or Z reason, which we already know what it means because it's important, because this person wrote it or it's about this subject. And you have to be really good to not only just get a good grade on it, but to impress the people who are going to be there when you recite it. If somehow, and that goes, you know, doubly true if that's the same shtick that you heard in Church X or Religious Chapter Y. You could fall under the shackles of Shakespeare. That could be Psalm, you know, 116 or Sonnet 4 or whatever. Pick the thing. So blessings on your head if you made it through those manacled poems. And they're like, this is going to prove to you why poetry is beautiful and means so much, and we endorse you loving it. If you came out of that somehow, even if it's many years later, think, there's got to be more to this than that, and I actually want to do it, because I've heard a thing or two that sounded what I'll just call poetic and beautiful, and I don't know. Even though I never experienced it, there's got to be something to it. Or maybe you had an inverse and like school never fit me and religions never fit me, but I've been inspired, but I basically just go by the trying to keep my fire lit by always adding tinder to it, mm. which burns hard and fast, but it's over and you got to keep on feeding it. Mm. And thought like, well, there's got to be more than just like always getting the big hit of emotion, because not all poems are like, you know, go and do and feel this. Sometimes it's, you know, sometimes some of the best fires to sit around are tender ones that you need to sort of poke a little bit and just feel, stay close enough to have the light and the warmth, but darkness is still around. Mm-hmm. And so, but if you somehow feel like you want to be in the field of poetry, but don't want it to feel like an accomplishment and feel like it could actually be in you, but you don't need to impress anyone, but you're interested in speaking the language of poetry without knowing that the language of poetry is very broad, this might be a good idea. But of course, you know, we know the sort of delight that when you in a stretch of conversation, as a response to someone, say a line from a song. Just as imagined, if someone said like, God, I'm really struggling right now and to hold on. If someone like genuinely said that, mm-hmm. but you said, you know, because you know this person, you're like, you know what? You got to hold on to what we got. It doesn't make a difference if we make it or not. And the other person says, yeah, we got each other, and that's a lot.
That's it. Yeah.
We'll make it a shot, and you both are like, oh, we're halfway there. We're living on a prayer. And suddenly, like, oh, it's the shared language of a Bon Jovi song that can suddenly like, all right, that's all right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and not to say that Bon Jovi is or isn't poetry, but that poetic response to say, like, oh, we can now talk like this with each other. Offers a different way of being in that moment with each other. And that could be funny or full of solace or sweetness. And so to include poetry, which are beautifully constructed words, and have those circling in your mind and being on your tongue as ways to be able to speak, not to impress anyone, but just to be like, oh,
yeah.
This might be a good idea to pick up, maybe.
I think there was a line, and maybe it was, I got it from Jonathan Rosen, effing the ineffable. which, as we know,
it's a great title. Great title.
Sometimes, but my experience of some of these things is there's such a, it's a physiological quickening when somehow through the formulation of words, a poem is able to describe an essence or a felt sense or something that you've experienced, and then reading or reciting of that, it transports you to that, and you have the effect within you. And as a result, like, you know, if we just sidestep into poetic sensibilities, which are something that naturally, I would imagine, naturally accrue or develop as one's affinity for the language of poetry and the experience of it all, it then also plays into this the infinite game, in the sense that you are and I'm not saying this in an achievement sense, it's more playing to continue the play, new possibilities, ways of relating, ways of seeing and perceiving and so on, blossom, even ways of relating to sorrow or heartbreak or disappointment and so on, open to you. And it just feels like the thread and connection to life with a capital L itself is vivified, or at least you know, that there's the connection feels... the connection is felt more. And, you know, and I like how you're emphasizing, well, not emphasize, but I like how you've made a couple of points. It's not to achieve things, because I can imagine a version of me in my 20s back in the achiever mode, but being like, oh yeah, committed to, I want to be able to learn how to memorize a few poems so that I can impress people at like a thing, and just da-da-da. That's fine. That's good. That's good. You know, finite games are okay.
There are poem memorizing maxers. I've met some of them recently. Like, oh, how many hours of poetry have you memorized? I'm like,
yes. We have friends that are, I don't know the correct term, birders or life.
Yeah, birders. Yeah.
And I think there's an interesting thing within the birding community too, because there are what's known as twitchers, the folks that will just go out and just try to see as many as they can, which is also great. You know, sure. It's like we all love birds. Then there's just, you know...
They're delicious.
Yeah, there's folks who like to be...
That's literally... why I go birding, yeah.
That's right. Well, our particular friends, a couple of professors... they love going birding. They'll go visit places around the world to simply be in the field, you know, to appreciate and see the birds. But one of my favorite places to visit is wastewater treatment plants, because birds love that shit. They like
literally
they're like the diversity of birds that gather around wastewater treatment plants is extreme. So do you want to perhaps? I mean, I can, but it will sound better coming from you. Give a sense of how the course. No, yeah, here I'm gonna do an attempt. You can fill in the gaps.
Okay.
So I'm hoping to get this podcast out soon. I've been procrastinating on it forever. I feel a mild chagrin about my previous works. I tend to have this habit of expressing my own inner world and insecurities and doubts and grapplings, which is. Does not do me wonders in terms of, authority and all of that in this world, but hopefully it's a relational thing that resonates. Yeah. When I did the, I'm hoping to get this out before so that some of my listeners can come along and experience this.
Yeah.
When I did it, I was, you know, there's a nervousness that comes to joining an online group. I've been in some groups that have been clumsily facilitated where I suddenly kind of feel like I'm on the spot and I'm instantly, instead of being present, I'm performing the role of what I should be doing because I know what the facilitator is trying to do. And then it feels like I'm just doing work. And that was, knowing you, that wasn't a strong concern that I had, but it was still like a concern based upon many
inertia. Yeah.
But the beautiful, warm way that you facilitate this, there is some, I don't want to give it away, but like there are just some, there's a natural grace, and I think the poetic sensibilities, the infinite play, the it's infused in how you go about this. And within, you know, the first 10 minutes, I was just, it just sidestepped all of those default ways that I had anticipated. And I was immersed in this budding at that sense. And yet by the end of the five sessions, this infused sense of kinship with the folks that were gathered on the call from all around the world. And the ways of how different poems were introduced and then the ways that were infused within us and the ways that suggested ways that we might approach the how we start to the practice and commit it to memory, commit it to heart, was just each time just felt so novel and natural. I'm coming back to the same, you know, the same gift kind of expression that you were talking before. It was just, is unlike anything I've done for so, so long. And by the end of the session, I often say, you know, the role of a good facilitator is to make themselves redundant. The side effect is the beautiful people that this type of thing that you are offering, when you light the beacon for this, the kinds of people this attracts is just beautiful. I'm still in touch with folks. The warmth of that was an unexpected boon. So as a result, I mean, I can't say I've fully imbibed all of the poems there. There's some I'm still working on them, but I'm deeply appreciated whatever it's exposed to and the approach and being part of your wonderful email list that happens on the other side of that. And so I would guess, I would just encourage for folks listening, if poetry, poetic sensibilities, poetic ways of seeing and being and knowing, if that has any kind of glimmer or register of, that I feel like I'm missing, I feel like there's a there that I could, like I feel drawn to this, I would heartily encourage you to check out Matthew's Committed to Memory, Committed to Heart course. And I believe, and this is the other thing I love about it too, the way to get on board with this is literally to send you an email, right?
Yeah, there's, I mean, Committed to Heart, it is heart first and memory second.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yes.
Oh, no, you said it, no. Both what you've only said it memory first this one time, but I just, I bring it up only because
Committed
it is
to heart
is first
my
because,
yeah.
Because the outcome of memorizing a poem is feels a little bit too much like school. And
yeah, but I
want there to be the possibility that you, not that you should have a particular relationship with these poems or poetry in general, but to have the heart as a point of entry, as a point, as opposed to extraction. And then I've got the poem.
Totally.
And so that you can go through the course, participate fully, and not have quote unquote memorized the poems, but sort of be in an ecological relationship with them and with other people. That's part of the thing. As much as, and look, and plenty of people finish like, oh, wow, these poems are now in me. Great. But this is a point of departure as opposed to a destination. As you and I both have come to know a little bit about, horizons are not as far as you can go. They're just as far as you can see. And so, and as you shift your position, new horizons emerge. So the goal is not to memorize three poems. The goal is to start to be in relationship with other people with these poems as the water and sandwiches that you've brought on the walk.
Yeah, yes. Oh, that's so good. Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's pretty good. I've never said that before until just now.
I like it. I like it a lot because, you know, instantly I'm also on, I've been on walks with friends and stuff like that. And there is something of a delight when, you know, when we're able to share what we have brought. I just want to double down on this for folks. The committed to heart thing, there's a parallel for me personally, which I think folks are maybe picking up on in my writing and all of that is heart-led thinking as well is the thing. For me, in my own journey, I did like thought-led hearting in some sense. Like I would like think.
I've been there too. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's just the language of the heart, the language of poetry, the way of being in the world that is heart-led and, you know, committed to heart being the orientation and disposition here, I just think that's the subtle yet significant profound magics of the offering here. Before I forget, what was your best email again? I'm terrible at remembering this, just in case people are listening and be like, oh, I want to send you an email.
Oh, mstillman, STILLMAN @gmail.com.
Great.
And yeah, just, yeah. You know, this particular one, if you hear this in time, we're going to be starting on an Eastern time, Sunday, May 3rd, starting at noon Eastern, or Monday, May 4th, starting at 7 p.m. Eastern. It's a four-week course. We look at three poems over 4 weeks. But maybe you're going to be hearing this at a point in the future that is way past when this is long slept. Well, you can email me anyway, and I'll let you know when it's happening next. And I'm happy to be in conversation with you. And so if you're hearing this in a time that's beyond May of 2026, I'm glad you made it that far. And I'd be glad to meet you if I'm still around. All willing, I am.
Yeah, nice. This could be pulled up from the archives. There could be folks studying this conversation in a few hundred years' time, just trying to figure out.
Oh, I'm sure, but you do need to send me an email. This is not. There's no funnel. There's no easy buy. There's no super promise about like just click this. And for $99 or $49, if you buy now, there's a special do it at home course. No, look, this is as in a digital medium as close to handedness as I can manage. Which is not a superior way of doing, but it's a different one. And so it is slower. It's not slick. There's no sales page, but I do have a write-up of what
it's superior.
Well, but if it's superior, it's losing in the economy of ideas, because other things, there's more of them and they go faster. This is just slower.
I know, right. In a chat that we had last week together with Kelly joining us, another friend that you've introduced me to, and I'm so grateful for. We're just kind of teasing
about
the best. The kind of like, you know, what this course could be. I mean, no shade on folks, but it could be like, you know, come join my online, you know, poetry course and stuff like that. And then there's video modules where you're in front of a green screen and there's dot points appearing. There's as you said, like an AI chatbot that if you want to like learn the things, sign up now and get a free PDF valued at $47 that will take you through the 12 secrets to blah.
Yeah, I mean, to really understand this shit, this sonnet, you know, click here.
Yeah, that's right. Oh,
God.
Yeah, you won't believe line 7. Wholesome. Yeah.
There's a Volta wholesome. Before the Volta. Below, yeah, people don't want to know about that.
beautiful. I I do find one of the gifts, and I don't know, it's one of those gifts in inverted commas of poetry is this beautiful perpetual unsettling. It's unsettled. No, sometimes it's settled, but like I said, there's a sense of something. I can only speak for myself, but there's an awakening that. What am I saying? There can be a wonderful effect in that nothing is quite. You start to see things in new ways and relate to things in new ways, including, you know, going about life in a way that is no longer optimized or optimal, and thus no longer as competitive or successful. I'm doing air quotes, by the way, in inverted commas, single inverted commas for those listening that can't see. You know, I find this is a common thing amongst poets and philosophers, often exist at the precariat, in the sense that they're not 10xing their business. They're not seeking exponential growth. Exit bias. And I suspect that it's because of attunement to the heart or something like that. There's a greater connection to what the, you know, again, I can only speak for myself, but this is what I was talking about, the kind of the gift in inverted commas is when the heart is part of how you orientate to life, you're less inclined to do things that aren't in concordance with the heart, which may render some business models a little less potent.
Bereft.
Bereft, yeah. Fair warning, but the wealth that comes from such an approach is worth it, I would say.
Thank you, and it's a shared wealth, all willing.
Yeah. This feels like we've come to a natural arc here. Is there anything else on your mind that you might want to like slip into the mix or?
Well, I'm just glad to be asked, and I love spending time with you, and I consider it to be one of the great, a lot of things had to go wrong for you and I to come to know each other, and I'm grateful for all those wrongnesses, because, yeah, I really, I cross my fingers. I mean, I have my own, you know, head-shaking relationship with aliveness and all the things that might mean. And getting dealt all kinds of strange cards, which I wouldn't have wished for, would sort of make the whole thing what it is. But man, am I glad that I have met you. And I, it's not the one, you know, thing that I hang my proverbial hat on, but I really do hope that I make it in such a good enough state to cross paths with you in the meat space. And I'm grateful for all the copper wires and glass tubes and smooth screens that have allowed us to come to know each other and to love each other. But to feel the temperature of you I'd be really glad for that to come to pass. And we've tried to conspire, you, me, and Kelly, to make that happen, and all willing, things will keep on going wrong in a good way.
Likewise, I live for the promise of the hug, the long held hug, and then all of the simple things, sitting by the fire or under the stars or whatever it may be, or having a walk and pulling out some snacks. And that's a beacon that I orientate to. It's been so wonderful. Like, I just feel so grateful that our lives have overlapped. And I'm really grateful that we had this opportunity to I mean, I always indulge. I mean, I was just asking you questions that I'd like to know, grappling with too. But hopefully also is for folks listening that you can get a little window into a friendship here that is ever generative. Thank you, Matthew.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah, well.
Thanks for having my back this way. I'm grateful. I'm lucky.
Wonderful. Well, so again, I will put some details of Matthew's world and work in the newsletter that comes with this podcast, and heartily encourage you find yourself in Matthew's world somehow. It's so nourishing. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Really appreciate it. Here's the thing, Matthew.
Yeah.
It was going so well, but I've just come up with this final thing. I find this such a lovely thing, so I'm going to telegraph this to you, so you've got time to like think, for your heart to respond. I like the gift of a question or something to consider, and I wonder if there's, and it's okay if not, but if there's a parting question or. Something to observe or something you might want to leave with folks that have listened to this conversation. I wonder what comes to you in this moment that might be something to contemplate.
Well, I've said a lot and so have you. So maybe if this was worth listening to, I wouldn't burden anyone to listen to it again unless for some reason you wanted to or you found yourself I wasn't paying attention and you were listening at it, you know, 2x speed and you're like, wait, what? But I wouldn't want to make any sort of pretentious notion that what we've said is so deep or anything like that. But maybe I would... retroactively hope that you heard some of the space and the silence in between what we were saying, and that that some of what we said came up from that. It wasn't just what we said, but it was some of those silences that we were responding to as well. And that if you hear that, and I think I heard some of that myself, that maybe that's something you could wonder about in real time with other people.
Thank you, Matthew.
Yeah, baby. Until soon.
Thanks, everyone.